Okay, the title of my talk is M-theory, field theory, and holography. And the talk is based on a paper I had on the FDH archive in December, so it's a long time ago. In this talk you'll hear about an entire sitter space, you'll hear about holography, but you won't hear about Maldacena's conjecture. So hopefully that's going to give a slightly new twist to the ideas of ADS and holography. The motivation is the ongoing search for a non-perturbative formulation of quantum M-theory, which is a very challenging problem, as we've learned over the last 3 years, because we don't seem to have any really satisfactory covariant non-perturbative or perhaps even background-independent formulation of quantum M-theory. We know some aspects of what M-theory should be about. It's definitely going to be something rather new in the sense that, for example, it's not a string theory, because we know, at least naively, that there should be at least one vacuum of this theory in 11 dimensions. And, of course, we don't know how to formulate any string theory in 11 dimensions. So we have to look for something radically new, perhaps. Today I would like to follow a slightly different strategy in which I would like to search for some kind of phenomenological formulation of a theory which actually reproduces some of the aspects of what we know about M-theory. For example, we know that, as I said, M-theory has an 11-dimensional super Poincaré vacuum, which is described at low energies by 11-dimensional supergravity. So any quantum theory which would be described at low energies in 11 dimensions by supergravity would be a good candidate for non-perturbative definition of M-theory. Also, we know that M-theory is microscopically parity invariant, at least if you believe in the consistency of heterotic E8 cross E8 strings, then M-theory has to be parity invariant. And also, since M-theory is supposed to contain quantum gravity, it's a theory which should be holographic, at least if you believe in the existence of a statistical interpretation for the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, as argued convincingly by Tuve and Susskind. By the way, this holography would, of course, mean holography at zero cosmological constant, because in 11 dimensions, there is no known supergravity with non-zero cosmological constant. So I'd like to address the issue of finding a theory which satisfies or exhibits all these properties in a phenomenological context. What I mean by this is a phenomenological theory in the spirit of, for example, Landau's Fermi-liquid theory, in which I would want to identify the minimal set of symmetries or symmetry principles that, when incorporated in a theory, will lead to supergravity as a low-energy effective theory and give us holography. Surprisingly enough, it turns out that this is perhaps possible within a very simple context of a field theory. Or maybe it's not that surprising when you recall the analogy with QCD as a theory of strong interactions, which came at a time when people were desperately looking for something very radical and very new as a theory for strong interactions, but the eventual answer turned out to be a very simple field theory. So, it turns out that one can formulate such a phenomenological theory which contains gravity and apparently satisfies the holographic principle as a generalization of our understanding of two plus one dimensional quantum gravity as a Chern-Simons gauge theory. This approach will be a generalization of that setup in the sense that what we'll find out is that when we write down a certain gauge theory in 11 dimensions, which will turn out to be described by an entire sitter Chern-Simons gauge theory, it will be possible to identify a certain regime in this theory, which is at very low energies described by conventional 11-dimensional supergravity. So at higher energies, the supergravity equivalence breaks down and the theory becomes a full-fledged Chern-Simons gauge theory. So that's a slight generalization of the 2 plus 1 dimensional context. In the process, we'll have to encounter several surprises. One of them will be that the theory will turn out to satisfy what I would like to call the modern analogy of Mach principle. Because if you start with a Chern-Simons gauge theory and expand this theory, or try to expand this theory near any of its obvious solutions, such as the entire Sitter space, it turns out that this expansion looks very unconventional. You wouldn't know how to deal with the degrees of freedom that might be contained in such a theory. In order to get a regime in the theory which does have a conventional effective field theory description of sophmos at very low energies, you have to introduce a large number of partonic degrees of freedom. So it turns out that to get a macroscopically large spacetime in which low energy particles propagate or inertia is generated, you have to introduce a large number of partons. So in this sense, the theory will satisfy Mach principle. You won't have a large spacetime with local propagating degrees of freedom unless you've introduced a large number of microscopic matter particles in the theory. And due to this relation between the size of the spacetime in this theory and the number of partons, or in other words, due to this relation between which will eventually be equivalent to a relation between the infrared and the ultraviolet cutoff, the theory will turn out to be holographic in two different ways. One can see that the theory is holographic. First of all, the number of partons in this theory will scale like the area of the surface surrounding the system that we are describing. So the partons are in some sense effectively 10-dimensional. And also, it will turn out that the low-energy supergravity effective theory will break down precisely when the Bekenstein bound is saturated, again in accordant holography. So let me start with formulating what this theory is. And again, I should stress that this is not meant to be some kind of fundamental microscopic definition of what M-theory is. This is some kind of phenomenological approach in which I try to stick to the minimal set of symmetries and fields which seem to exhibit these interesting structures expected from M-theory. So I'm not necessarily saying that this Chern-Simons theory is the ultimate starting point in this formulation. Perhaps one should think of the Chern-Simons theory as coming from integrating out some more microscopic degrees of freedom. But I don't have any more microscopic formulation, so I'll stick to the phenomenological approach. So I'll write down the theory as a theory for a gauge field one form on an 11-dimensional manifold, and I won't choose any background metric on that 11-dimensional manifold, and I won't introduce any dynamical metric field, because just as in 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity, the dynamical metric will turn out to be contained as one component of the gauge field eventually. So my gauge symmetries will be just the Yang-Mills gauge symmetries acting on the gauge field one form, and I'll assume that the theory is diffeomorphism invariant. In addition, in order to restrict the number of terms that are compatible with these symmetries in the Lagrangian, I'll impose parity invariance. And also, of course, we know that M theory is parity invariant, so it's a good idea to impose parity if we want to make any contact with M theory. So if I impose these symmetries, then the only terms allowed in the Lagrangian which are polynomial are just given by Chern-Simons terms of various kinds, in the sense that depending on what gauge group you choose, and I'll just discuss that in detail in a second, there are various invariant symmetric six tensors on the gauge group which define a set of Chern-Simons 11 forms. Since the gauge potential is of dimension 1, these couplings here in front of the Chern-Simons forms are all dimensionless, and the precise definition would of course of the precise definition of this Lagrangian would, of course, require us to extend the theory to 12 dimensions, in the sense that you choose a 12-dimensional manifold whose boundary is given by your 11-dimensional manifold, and integrate the exterior derivative of the Chern-Simons form over that manifold. And if you look in more detail at this definition, and you realize that in some cases, due to some simple cohomological arguments, the couplings in front of the Chern-Simons forms can be quantized, just as in 2 plus 1 dimensions. So this is the basic Lagrangian, and of course, as I just mentioned, in addition to the Gaussian invariance I've already introduced, I have to impose parity invariance. The naive parity, which just reverses the sign of one of the space-time coordinates, is not a symmetry of any Chern-Simons theory, because all Chern-Simons forms change their sign under such space-time parity transformation. So in order to get a theory which can be parity invariant, you have to supplement the space-time action of the parity transformation by an internal action on the gauge group. So that tells me that I have to tell you exactly what the gauge group is, so that I can specify how parity acts on that gauge group. In order to eventually get a regime in this theory where there are propagating degrees of freedom near a certain homogeneous space-time, I have to start with an anti-de Sitter group. It wouldn't be possible to start with a super Poincaré group, for example, and get local propagating degrees of freedom and holography. So anti-de Sitter is indeed crucial for all that will follow later. So I'll start with an anti-de Sitter bosonic group in 11 dimensions, on which there is an invariant 6 tensor given by this epsilon tensor here. And I want my leading term in the Lagrangian, the irreducible Chern-Simons form for my gauge group, to contain this piece. Of course, my gauge group has to be a supergroup which has at least 32 supercharges, because we know that M theory has 32 supersymmetries. If I extend the anti-de Sitter group by 32 supercharges, it's well known that I have to introduce extra bosonic five-form charges, and the minimal extension of the bosonic anti-de Sitter is given by OSP 132. However, it can be demonstrated easily that this is not compatible with the requirement of parity invariance. You cannot define parity in any sensible way on such a gauge group. And if you insist on parity, it turns out that the minimal choice of the gauge group you have, which is an anti-de Sitter, contains at least 32 supercharges and is compatible with parity, is OSP 132 cross OSP 132, so contains 64 supercharges. So now I have a gauge theory, a classical theory in principle, which contains Chern-Simons terms in the Lagrangian, and the gauge field is in the adjoint of the particular superextension of the ADS group I mentioned. So let me identify what these various components of the gauge field will mean. This is going to be the component of the field bind, just as in 2 plus 1 gravity. This is going to be the spin connection eventually. These are going to be some higher order form generators which will decouple mostly at low energies. And this is going to be the candidate for the gravitino field, and these are some extra fermions. So formally I would define the theory at least classically in terms of the Lagrangian I mentioned, and it's interesting to notice that these equations of motion, of course, are of higher order in fields, and it's very hard to make any sense of this theory non-perturbatively. Of course, it's not possible to... it's not clear to me whether it's possible to expand this theory in any sensible way near some hypothetical infrared free field fixed point or something. So the strategy that I'll follow in trying to understand this formal theory is as follows. I'll try to identify a regime in which there are local propagating degrees of freedom, so there would be a well-defined expansion with propagators and interaction terms described by some effective low-energy field theory. In order to do that, I'll first discuss what I understand by a flat 11-dimensional spacetime as a specific configuration of this gauge field. And then I'll try to identify a regime in this theory in which I can expand near a flat 11-dimensional spacetime manifold. So these components of the gauge field, as I said, should be identified just as in 2 plus 1 gravity with the components of the Philbin field. However, these, of course, are of dimension 1 as components of the gauge field. So in order to write down the expression for the flat Philbin, for example, as a particular gauge field configuration, you have to introduce a mass scale. So you introduce a mass scale here, and these EMAs are just dimensionless Philbin components. In particular, the flat space would be given just by these numbers. Of course, it's impossible to expand this theory near a flat spacetime because the flat spacetime is not a classical solution of the theory. It would be possible, in principle, to perhaps try to expand near an anti de Sitter solution. However, if you try to expand near an anti de Sitter solution, of course, there are no terms quadratic in the field fluctuations in the Lagrangian, because the Lagrangian is of a very high order in fields. Therefore, you have to do something extra in order to identify a regime in this theory, which is described by low energy field theory with regular propagators and so on. I'll do that on the next transparency, but before I do that, I'll have to interpret this mod scale M. In order to do that, you can integrate this 10 form over a 10-dimensional space-like slice of that 11-dimensional manifold, which is something which should be of order 1. This is just a number. And if you rewrite everything in terms of the real dimensionless field binds, this on the left-hand side is just the volume of the space-like slice. And therefore, M can be interpreted as the inverse size of the system. So that's my interpretation of that mass scale M. In order to get propagating degrees of freedom near flat spacetime, you introduce partons into the theory in the sense that recalls some historical formulations of Mach's principle. If you write down the equation of motion for that pure transimus theory in terms of the Riemannian curvature and not in terms of the anti de Sitter curvature, then of course you get something schematically of this type. So ADS would be a solution, but there is no kinetic term for fluctuations near that ADS solution. However, the Minkowski space, of course, is not a solution. So in order to make it a solution, you realize that since the theory is a theory of one gauge field form, the theory couples naturally to particles. So you can choose a specific representation, unitary representation of the gauge group, and introduce a large number of particles or partons, which show up effectively in the equation of motion on the right-hand side as a source, as a current. So that changes the equation of motion. And now I'll make a mean field ansatz in which, at very long wavelengths, when compared to the characteristic size, characteristic distance between these partons, I'll assume that there is such a representation R which gives me this form of the current. I replace the sum of delta functions localized at these contours by homogeneous field, and this is going to be my ansatz for the mean field. And it turns out that once you make this ansatz, which is just about the only sensible thing one can assume, all kinds of interesting things happen. First of all, the flat Minkowski space will be a solution of the mean field equation of motion. And it turns out that the transimus coupling is related to the number of partons by this formula. And one can therefore try to expand now near the Minkowski space and ask oneself what the effective field theory is. And what we'll find out is that at very low energies, this theory will be equivalent to supergravity. But once we reach a certain energy scale which will be much lower than the naively expected Planck mass cutoff. There will be a crossover to a certain Chern-Simons ADS description, which still will be valid in the mean field approximation. In other words, once you reach the Bekenstein bound, your theory is no longer described by effective supergravity low energies, but will become something else. Okay, thank you. So, now the question is whether the mean field ansatz I've chosen is plausible, or whether there is a representation of the particular ADS gauge group I've chosen which might satisfy that mean field condition. And it turns out that there will be various indications in the remaining 4.5 minutes of the talk that will tell us that the obvious candidate for this representation, which does indeed satisfy this condition, is the supersingleton representation of the gauge group. So let me move on to the low energy field theory near the flat space solution of the mean field equation of motion. So for small fluctuations near the flat space, and again, by the way, here I will just stick to the bosonic part to illustrate the main point. So the Lagrangian will contain all kinds of terms like this, where R is the Riemannian curvature and E is the dimensionless Philbin field. In particular, there will be an Einstein-Hilbert term in the Lagrangian, which is multiplied by m to the 9th. M is the infrared cutoff, essentially, or the inverse size of the system. And there is g squared, 1 over g squared in front of the Lagrangian, which, as I said before, is equal to n. So in order to get a low energy field theory dominated by the Einstein-Hilbert term, you just identify m to the 9th times n as the Planck mass to the 9th, or the Newton constant inverse. So in this sense, you go to the limit where mp, defined as I just mentioned, is fixed, n goes to infinity, and m goes to 0. So m, being the inverse size of the system, if it goes to 0, means that we are looking at a very large system. N is the number of partons in sustaining that large system. So n is going to be large. Mp is going to be fixed. In that limit, the effective Lagrangian description, or at least the leading bosonic part that I'm focusing on here, will be the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. There will be corrections of a higher order in curvature, which are suppressed, indeed, by the second inverse power of the Planck mass, but there is an extra power of n, which makes a big difference in the whole setup. So the limit of validity in which this term here is smaller than the leading Einstein-Hilbert term is actually much stronger than the naive Planckian bound, and it turns out that this is precisely compatible with the holography. So now let me go directly to demonstrating that the theory satisfies the holographic principle. First of all, this identification of the Planck mass in terms of the number of partons and the inverse size of the system, by doing some simple algebra, you can actually show that n, being the number of partons sustaining that system, scales like the area measured in Planck units. So this is indeed what we expect from a holographic theory. Another argument showing that the theory is holographic goes like this. If you now go back to that bound on the validity of the supergravity approximation and look at a configuration which, roughly speaking, saturates that bound, calculate the energy of that system, again, after some very simple algebra, you come to the conclusion that the maximum energy allowed in a system by the requirement of the validity of the supergravity low energy approximation is precisely given by the Schwarzschild mass, by the mass of the Schwarzschild black hole of the same size, which is precisely one of the formulations of the holographic principle. I'll skip the part in which I wanted to show you how local super diffeomorphisms at low energies cross over to super Yang-Mills symmetries at higher energies. And I'll tell you a few words about low energy supersymmetry. So first of all, it's possible to show that diffeomorphisms are indeed gauge symmetries, dynamical gauge symmetries at low energies. and become equivalent to Chern-Simons gauge symmetries only at higher energies. And then one question that one could actually be interested in answering is where the rest of the supergravity multiplet comes from in 11-dimensional supergravity as the low energy effective theory, namely where the Chern-Simons 3 form comes from. And there's a natural ansatz which seems to be working in which the 3 form is actually a composite field made out of at low energies out of 3 gauge fields. And more microscopically, it would be described by a certain Chern-Simons 3 form of that gauge group. So I don't think I have any more time to discuss details, but maybe I can answer some questions. Thank you.
Questions?
Oh, okay. Yes, the question was whether I can actually talk about the part I skipped, in which diffeomorphisms. How do diffeomorphisms appear as gauge symmetries at low energies? So, thank you for asking that question. The idea is, roughly speaking, that the microscopic gauge, Young-Mills gauge theory here is invariant under gauge translations. While on the other hand, I'm claiming that at low energies, the effective theory is supposed to be super diffeomorphism invariant. And of course, in 2+1 dimensions, there is a similar question, which is the answer in 2+1 dimensions is somewhat trivial because these two symmetries turn out to be on-shell equivalent. Here, in this case, it turns out that only at low energies, the theory actually has super diffeomorphisms as symmetries. One can see that in the following manner. First of all, the microscopic gauge symmetry group is at very low energies effectively contracted by setting MP to zero in these formulas here, or actually sending N to infinity in these formulas. And it can be shown that the error is small for configurations which satisfy that Bekenstein bound on the validity of the supergravity approximation. So, in a slightly more explicit way, if you vary the effective Lagrangian under gauge translations, so if you vary the Einstein-Hilbert term under gauge translations, you do indeed get a non-zero result, which is proportional to the torsion. However, so this low-energy Lagrangian is not invariant under microscopic gauge translations. It is indeed super diffeomorphism invariant. However, the microscopic theory is still invariant under gauge translations, and that's because this non-zero here gets cancelled by a non-zero which comes from the variation of the systematically suppressed higher order terms in curvature, because in the microscopic theory the variation of the Riemannian curvature is non-zero. It only at low energies, when the effective gauge group essentially contracts, this would be zero. In the microscopic theory, this is non-zero, and the variation of this term cancels against the variation of that term. So there is a sort of there's a systematic cancellation of these terms, which is systematically ignored by the low energy observer, who only sees the super diffeomorphisms or diffeomorphisms in this particular case. We can discuss that in more detail if that's necessary in private.
Okay.
Yes.
Can you from this one get n-dimensional effective spring action, reproduce the R to the fourth coupling, for example?
The question is whether one can get a 10-dimensional action from this. In principle, one could try to compactify on a circle, and I'm not sure I've been able to get very far with that. But so I don't have any specific answer to that question. I think in principle it should be possible, but I haven't tried it yet.
We have to move on to the next speaker, so let's thank Peter again.